AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Our technical director is Jason Croft. Located just south of Decatur, the community of Macon, Illinois, has not had a high school of its own since the early 1990s. But 41 years ago, in a time before prep sports were placed in classes by school population, the Macon Ironmen baseball team made its mark on history with a championship drive that fell one victory short. The new book, One Shot at Forever, chronicles that unlikely run and the unconventional coach that led the team there. Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Ballard says the book started with a letter from a native of Macon. Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert spoke with Ballard and explains.
A gentleman named Chris Collins, who was 10 years old at the time, was living in Macon, and he watched this team and these guys as they made this amazing baseball run. So he saw it through the eyes of a boy. You know, these were his heroes. And so he contacted me and laid it out a little bit. You know, we get a lot of emails like that at SI, but it's something about this one definitely intrigued me. So I called him back, talked a little bit. It sounded good, but it wasn't until I met Lynn Sweet and saw him and got a chance to talk to him that I was really sold on it, because just he's a complicated guy. He's a charismatic guy. And I was able, even meeting him now at the point he was in his late 60s, I could see who he'd been back then.
A complicated guy and certainly an unorthodox coach and teacher. I love how you got into this book before we even take to the ball field, just some of his interesting methods in the classroom.
Oh, yeah. My wife's a teacher. My grandmother's a teacher. So I ate this stuff up, just this idea of Lynn coming into this super conservative town where everything had always been done by the book. And the first thing he does is just throw out the grammar textbooks, and he starts introducing these books that, you know, in 1966, 67, reading books like Brave New World, that was not something that was done in a small town like Macon. And asking these kids to think bigger, to think out of the box, you know, write your obituary for me. I want you to think about not just what you're doing now, but what you're going to do down the line. You know, getting students to think of him as an equal rather than as authority figure. It was during an era when there was a fair amount of disciplining, you know, paddling of kids, things like that. And Lynn never had to resort to that because he had earned the students' respect, and they also liked him.
There was also just no emphasis on baseball at the time. I know this is an entirely different story, but it made me think of The Rookie, the true story with the movie with Dennis Quaid, where they're in Texas and the emphasis was football. At Macon High School at the time, you had to scratch and claw just to get equipment. Talk about the efforts he made and how he was recruited to become, Lynn Sweet was recruited to become baseball coach.
No one wanted to coach. They'd had a succession of coaches who'd been pulled from the school and coached one year and then bowed out. And the most recent one had been the football coach, Jack Burns, who was a great football coach, but just really had no interest in baseball. And so they were getting too close to the season. They needed a coach, and they sort of asked the faculty, and there's only, a couple dozen faculty. And it finally was the parents who sort of went after Sweet a bit and said, hey, we like you as a teacher. Our kids like you. Give it a shot. He'd played some softball with a couple of them. But as you said, this was a place where football and basketball were king at the time. And even track, from what the guys told me, was more important than baseball. It was in the spring. It was horrible weather. The team wasn't very good. A couple seasons earlier, they'd only won one game. They had a bunch of young talent coming up, but that wasn't necessarily apparent at the time. These guys are... they're going to Commodore's games and trying to get old bats, broken bats, and they tape them up with duct tape. They find old baseballs and use them till they're down to the string. It certainly was not, they have 12 kids on the team, maybe 13, and a couple of them probably weren't very good. It was that kind of operation, but they all loved it.
Yeah, something that I found particularly funny was the area behind second base was also the landing point for the discus.
Yes, and so talking to center, the outfielders, they told me, you really just had to learn to play it that way. Like, the ball might just stop. And if there was a short blooper, it might just go thunk and land in that divot there.
I know a lot of people around here would be familiar with what Macon High School was, but can we talk about just going back 41 years and what high school sports were at the time and how a team like Macon would end up playing a team like Waukegan and how there were so many smaller schools around Central Illinois?
Yeah, this is what I find really compelling is this idea, much like Hoosiers, the movie, since there wasn't a class system, you had a chance to advance all the way, but very few schools did. I mean, you'd get a school of maybe 500 to 600 kids might make it to the state playoffs, which were the final eight teams in Peoria. But you had to win. You had to win more games than an NCAA team has to win during March Madness to get there. So you're talking about defying the odds again and again in the regional and the sectional level and going up. So, you know, Macon's playing schools that are, you know, Macon has 220 kids, and they're playing schools that first they're playing 1,000-kid schools from Decatur and then it's moving up. And then when they play Lane Tech, and there's a school that at the time was over 5,000 students, and they were all boys, and there was this huge powerhouse. You know, and they play Waukegan, which had 2,000-plus kids and players on their way to the major leagues, and where they had, you know, these tremendous cuts from the team, and Macon has had 12 kids, and whoever showed up, and that was their team.
Then the 1970 season rolls around, and they're really, really good, and then this technicality cancels their run for the championship. They didn't do anything wrong, but any kind of lessons to be learned there or some kind of resolve just in the way they played the next season?
Yeah, you know, I think it was toughest because there were a couple of seniors who didn't get to come back, and, you know, to this day, a lot of the guys talk about that 70 team might have been more talented, and they don't know how far they might have gone had they had a chance. I think coming back, there was definitely a resolve, and there was a sense that, well, you know, we never did lose, so, you know, there's no reason we shouldn't think we're that good. So even though they came from this tiny town without any baseball history, in talking to these players, you know, they really were confident at the time. They really felt, hey, we can compete with these guys. There's no reason why we can't. And, you know, I think part of it was having Sweet come back, and, you know, in the interim, the school had fired him as baseball coach, and some of the students and parents rallied around him a bit and got him back in there. So they had a sense of a little bit of us against the world, I think, which helped them.
Yeah, and maybe they didn't realize quite how good they were, and maybe didn't even realize finishing second, the way that the celebration went afterwards, maybe it sunk in a little more what had happened to them.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's one of those electric moments when you're that age. Personally, you know, I'm turning 39, and I still remember with amazing clarity these moments from my high school sports career. And I think there's a couple of those guys, John Henneberry especially, who's the lefty pitcher with the big slow curveball, who they understood at the time how rare this moment was for them to have this experience. But the rest of them were just high school kids. Hey, you know, it's a great run kind of thing.
Now, the trophy, is that right, sitting in a gas station now? Or
yeah, it's a gas station. When you first come into Macon, you know, you don't even go to town. It's right off the highway there. And that's one of the things that first drew me to the story of this idea. You know, what's happened in these intervening 40 years where this was the proudest moment, proudest sports moment at least, and one of the proudest moments of this town at the time. And now this trophy's in a gas station, you know, not forgotten, but it's on a sort of dusty higher shelf. There's a couple of things in front of it. It's next to the Jack Daniels. You know, what happened in those intervening 40 years for this to lose its permanence, for this disintegration of collective memory, which is part of what intrigued me.
Is this book accomplishing some of maybe what you'd hope for this region and bring new appreciation for such a small school team to have gotten so far?
Yeah, and I'm not even sure how much of it. Obviously, the book is a catalyst, but what I thought was impressive, you know, I did a book signing there in Decatur at the public library, and the whole team, except for Brian Snicker, who's currently the third base coach for the Braves, so the whole team, other than the members who are now deceased, came out. And they sat there, and about 10 minutes into this talk, you know, over 300 people showed up to this. You know, the woman who introduced it at the library looked out at this crowd, and they'd had to open an extra room and said, did y'all leave anyone in Macon tonight, you know? And the players just talked about it. And then Steve Scharcher comes in a little late, and he gets a standing ovation. And just to see this, the power of a small town like that, you know, raising up its high school baseball heroes from four decades ago, I can't imagine that happening. You know, where I went to high school, people have forgotten a lot of that. So it was really touching to see it and to see the power of that community.
Sports Illustrated writer Chris Ballard, he's the author of One Shot at Forever, about the 1971 Macon High School baseball team that finished second to Waukegan in the state championship finals. He spoke with Illinois Public Media's Jeff Bossert. There's a slideshow of photos on our website, will.illinois.edu.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 4th of September, 2012. It was on this day in 1998 that Google was incorporated, the brainchild of two PhD students at Stanford, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who designed a search engine that was different from the others. Instead of giving you results based on how many times your search term appeared on a web page, they created software that would figure out how many times each relevant website was linked to from other relevant websites, and sorted those and then laid them out for you on a very clear, simple screen. In June of 2006, Google was added to the Oxford English Dictionary as a verb. It's the birthday of Richard Wright, born on a plantation near Natchez, Mississippi, 1908. Came north, became a writer, author of the novel Native Son, came out in 1940, about a black man, Bigger Thomas, gets a job as a chauffeur for a beautiful young white woman, accidentally kills her. A huge bestseller when it came out, made into a Broadway play, now required reading at many high schools. This day in 1666 was the most destructive day of the Great Fire of London, which had begun a few days before, people scurrying to get their possessions out of the path of the fire. And the diarist Samuel Pepys wrote about the chaos and confusion in the streets, the people running, pushing carts full of belongings, the fire coming on in the narrow streets with infinite fury. He wrote, "I saw how horridly the sky looks all on a fire in the night was enough to put us out of our wits, and indeed it was extremely dreadful, for it looks just as if it was at us and the whole heaven on fire. I, after supper, walked in the dark down to Tower Street, and there saw it all on fire, at the Trinity House on that side and the Dolphin Tavern on this side, which was very near us, and the fire with extraordinary vehemence." The system of firefighting basically was to demolish houses in the path of the fire, hoping to create a fire break. The following day, September the 5th, the Great Fire was officially over, and it all started on September the 2nd when the King's Baker in Pudding Lane had neglected to turn the ovens off all the way. London was a city of 80,000 people, and historians estimate that the Great Fire destroyed the homes of 70,000 of them, as well as almost 90 churches, all the official buildings. St. Paul's Cathedral was burned, and all of medieval London within the old Roman city wall. Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, entitled The Highway. It seems too enormous just for a man to be walking on, as if it and the empty day were all there is, and a little dog trotting in time with the heat waves off near the horizon, seeming never to get any farther. The sun and everything are stuck in the same places, and the ditch is the same all the time, full of every kind of bone, while the empty air